4 for March Madness is set. The NFL approves a new 17-game schedule. The Deshaun Watson allegations get worse. In a sit-down with Spaceballs, Austin Space. LaValley Sports Talk begins right now. What's going on, everybody? Welcome into another edition of the LaValley Sports Talk Podcast, brought to you by the Sound Network. As always, I'm your host, Chris LaValley. Hope you're all doing well and staying safe. Let's kick off the pod. We're going to break down the Final Four matchups for both the men's and women's NCAA basketball tournament. We'll do that very quickly, and then we'll get on to some NFL talk. So, Gonzaga, UCLA, and Baylor and Houston are your men's Final Four matchups. Gonzaga took down USC in the early eight matchup, 85-66. UCLA topped Michigan, 51-49. And then you had Baylor, who beat out Arkansas 81-72. And then Houston dominated Oregon State 67-61. I know that score sounds close, but Houston was in control of that game from the jump. The final score does not indicate how much Houston did truly beat down Oregon State. So again, your final four matchups are going to be Gonzaga versus UCLA and Baylor versus Houston. I'm going to take the two favorites. I'm taking Gonzaga and Baylor to make it to the finals, and I picked Gonzaga at the beginning of the tournament to win the whole thing, and I'm going to stick to that. I think Gonzaga is the best team. They've been the best team. They're undefeated throughout the season, so I'm gonna go Gonzaga. I really do think that the way that they haven't just played incredible basketball. I think they have the best. They have the best player coming that's going to be coming out of college into the NBA next season, and none of the games have been close. I mean, realistically speaking, if you've watched Gonzaga play throughout this tournament, the games haven't been close. And Gonzaga, especially near the end of halves, if you watch them, they go on these runs, especially in the first half, with about, I don't know, a minute and a half left in a half. They might be up 3, 4, 5, 6 points, and then you blink, and all of a sudden they went on like a 10-0 run. They have this habit of really stepping on the gas near the end of half and just setting themselves so far ahead that coming into the second half, they're already in a dominant lead, and they coast in every second half because they can. I don't see how anybody right now is going to beat Gonzaga. They've been, like I said, they've been the most dominant team throughout the regular season. They've been the most dominant team in this tournament. So again, I like Gonzaga to face Baylor in the championship, and I like Gonzaga to take it. Then we go to the women's bracket, and we've got Stanford against South Carolina and UConn against Arizona. So we've got three number ones and a number three seed. So Stanford beat up on Louisville in their Elite Eight matchup, 78-63. South Carolina destroyed Texas in their Elite Eight matchup, 62-34. UConn squeaked by Baylor, 69-67, which I'm going to touch on that game in a minute. And Arizona beat up on Indiana, 66-53. So we've got the three number one seeds. So you got Stanford, South Carolina, and UConn, and then the number three seed is Arizona. So real quick, I'll give you who I think is going to move on, who is going to win the national championship, and then I do want to touch on UConn and Baylor. So Stanford and South Carolina are facing off. I like Stanford. I pick Stanford to make it to the national championship game in my bracket. I'm going to stick to that. I think Stanford is a better team than South Carolina overall. I don't even think South Carolina should have been the one seed, to be honest with you. I thought Baylor should have been the one seed over South Carolina, but that's for another day. And then I have UConn beating the number three ranked Arizona. So I have UConn and Stanford. I picked UConn to win the whole thing, and I'm going to stick to that. I don't bet against UConn, as you've heard in previous podcasts before. I don't bet against Gino Auriemma, and I don't bet against UConn in the women's college basketball tournament. So the UConn-Baylor game, that was one hell of a game. And look, a lot of people have issue with the fact that UConn essentially got away with a foul call. So to set the stage here, Baylor was trailing 68-67 with 5 seconds left, and Baylor guard Carrington appeared to be fouled by two Husky players, Edwards and Alota, and as she went up for a shot, and there was no foul call, and it looked like after the fact that she got hit on the elbow. Now, when the game was live, when I was watching the game, I thought it was a good non-call. Then I saw the replay and I went, oop, she kind of got fouled. Now, with that being said, all right, throughout the game, I was on Twitter. I was following what people were saying, mainly because I actually enjoy women's college basketball. Twitter is kind of fun. It's not as nasty and gross as like NBA Twitter when people are just nasty at each other. Most people when it comes to women's college basketball Twitter, even men's college basketball Twitter, it's actually kind of just a fun place to be. Like, people trash talk, but it's not in a nasty or gross way. So anyway, I was following it, and throughout the game, in my opinion, and a lot of UConn people too, were getting pissed off because they felt like UConn was getting screwed with non-calls. And you had all the Baylor people, and there are a lot of Baylor people, by the way, in the media, you know, our objective quote-unquote sports media, were definitely rooting towards Baylor, and you could tell by the way the tweets were going out. And they had said that the refs had set the stage early in the game, as the commentators did too, both Ryan Rucco and Rebecca Lobo, who were calling the game for ESPN or ABC, whomever, had made the comment that the refs decided early on, and you could tell by the way that they were calling the game, that the refs were going to let the ladies play. Okay, so just put that full disclosure. So then you had Baylor Twitter sitting there and going, well, look, the refs are just letting the girls play. That's the way that it works. And so if that's the case, you can't then turn around and bitch about how the UConn women got away with one when if the shoe was on the other foot, you would have been okay with it because meaning Baylor fans, have said throughout the game, well, the refs are just letting the girls play. So either the refs are letting the girls play or they're not. And we're not talking about like it was a straight up hack. She got her elbow as she was going up for the shot, but it wasn't like any of the UConn players absolutely took her out while she was taking the shot. It was a physical game throughout, all the way to the end. And the refs decided to swallow the whistle as they had throughout the game. So the refs were being consistent. So I kind of do have a hard time with whether this is being framed. Now, obviously, I am a UConn fan. I was rooting for UConn. I'm rooting for UConn throughout the tournament. I root for UConn every single year. Y'all know my bias. If the shoe was on the other foot, if I'm being honest, would I be pissed if there was a non-call? Absolutely, after the fact. But like I said, during the game, when I was watching the game, I was expecting it to be physical because the refs hadn't called anything throughout the game. So again, as a Baylor fan, do I understand why they're upset? Sure. But all the people on Twitter, including the media people who are rooting for Baylor, you guys can't sit there and write an article. Like, UConn's headline is Baylor calls foul on non-call at the end of the Elite Eight loss to UConn. And then you read the article, and the way that the article was written on ESPN was pretty much saying that, you know, Baylor got hosed. Well, Baylor technically didn't get hosed because if the refs were calling the game as stringently as you wanted them to call the game in the last 5 seconds, UConn would have won the game in a blowout because they would have been standing on the free throw line the entire second half. So again, you can't have it both ways. So either you want the refs to call the game tightly or you don't. So look, I know I'm making a big deal about this and it's obviously not the end of the world, but I do find it interesting how many people now all of a sudden don't like UConn or they root against UConn. And I know it's the fact that UConn is dominating women's college basketball and have for a long time. Speaking of UConn, real quick, because I love touting how great Gina Auriem is as a coach and how wonderful UConn is, because to me, I think it's underreported and Gina doesn't get enough credit. UConn has headed to its 13th consecutive, that's right, 13th consecutive women's Final Four with the chance at winning its 12th national championship. John Wooden went to 9 straight Final Fours. Just saying. Just keep that in the back of your mind. When you're thinking about best coach of all time, basketball coach. Like I said, Gina Auriemma needs to be on the top of that list. But anyway, I digress. So, Final Four is set for both the men's and the women's tournament. It's going to be great. I'm taking Gonzaga in the men's, and I'm taking UConn in the women's. And of course, next week, we'll break it all down and discuss. All right, so for NFL Corner, we'll talk the new 17-game schedule first, and then I'll touch on how the Deshaun Watson allegations, oh boy, those have gotten real bad. So, let's have some positive fun here, or at least I think it's positive fun. The players don't really seem to think so. The NFL owners have approved a 17-game season starting in 2021. So this is an excerpt from ESPN. NFL owners approved the expansion of the regular season to 17 games Tuesday, a long-expected decision that will generate additional revenue for the country's richest sports league. Players agreed to the additional game as part of their 2020 collective bargaining agreement, which gave the league an option to expand as soon as 2021 season. The preseason will be reduced from 4 games to 3 to maintain compliance with the CBA, which limits the total number of preseason and regular season games played to 20. There will remain one bye week per team. The season will begin on Thursday night, September 9th, and will end on January 9th, 2022. The Pro Bowl will be played on February 6th, 2022, which means that a bunch of players will play Madden again because the Pro Bowl is a joke. And the Super Bowl has been pushed back from February 6th to February 13th, and the Super Bowl is going to be at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles. Also, what's really cool is that the 17th game is going to be interconference, so AFC versus NFC type way that they're matching it up, which I think is really cool. So I'm pumped about the fact that we're getting a 17th game. Now, most football fans, from what I've seen on social media and everything, they're excited too. Some of the players, not so much. We've had a couple players out there that have been tweeting about how this is ridiculous and we're really going to let this happen, man. And, you know, this is just dumb. I'm not kidding. That was actually a tweet. This is ... dumb. Y'all collectively bargained this. This was something that you, as a players union, decided. And of course, there's all the people in the media immediately putting out the narrative of NFL owners are evil, corrupt bastards who clearly don't care about the safety of the players because they're adding an additional game. What's funny about that is that Roger Goodell cited the league data that had traced the highest rate of player injuries to preseason games. Many of those who play extensively in preseason games are backups and other players unlikely to make the team. But again, that's where we're seeing the majority of injuries come in the preseason. So Roger Goodell was quoted as saying this: what we are actually doing is following the data and following the science to make sure that we are doing things well, both from a health and safety standpoint, as well as seeking to get better in every way, end quote. So again, it's kind of hard for the media to run with this narrative and for some of the players or the player activists, I should call them, to keep talking about how, well, you know, clearly the NFL doesn't care about the safety of the players, when the data is showing that the majority of those that get injured are getting injured in the preseason. And look, if you don't like it, if you don't like the fact that, or if you're a starter and you don't want to play 17th game, then don't play 17th game. You're very likely not going to anyway. If you're one of the top players on your team, you usually get shut down by week 15, week 16 anyway. So you getting shut down for week 17 is very much a likely scenario. But what's funny is the players that get sat because they don't want to play or the team doesn't want them to play and risking them of getting injured prior to the playoffs, I don't see them giving up game checks for that. I don't see them saying, you know what, I'm not going to play, so here's my game check for the game because I'm obviously not contributing to the team's success. So for, again, you know, it's funny how players, they bitch about how they're not getting paid enough money because they're not getting compensated for all the games, yet they want to get compensated even when they're sitting on the sidelines holding a clipboard. You know, it's funny how that works out. So anyway, I think it's a smart move. Do I think that this is going to continue as the years progress, that we're going to see an 18th, 19th, 20th game? Maybe. It's possible. I mean, obviously, if the revenue is going to be there, if the NFL is looking to make, if they're going to continue to make more money, then yeah, sure, possibly we could be looking at a 20-game season. But as a fan, I mean, it's kind of hard for me to complain about more football. But it's also hard for me to really buy into the complaints of the players. So Tuesday's approval came 1 year after the owners expanded the playoff field from 12 to 14 games, a decision that created two additional playoff games and was estimated to generate $150 million in additional annual revenue. Most NFL revenue is split with players according to the terms of the CBA. The addition of the 17th game pushes for the players' distribution to 48.5% of shareable revenue. Since players share the revenue that is bought into the NFL, more money for the NFL means more money for the players as well. The new CBA also increases the players' revenue share as part of the negotiated media kicker, which comes into effect when we play 17 regular season games. As a result, players will see even larger revenue increases in future years when the new media revenues really begin. And this was from the NFL Players Association said in a statement. So again, it's not like the players aren't being compensated for playing the extra game. It may not be in their salary by the team, but they are gaining more revenue from the NFL as a product. So they are going to be making more money when it's all said and done. But again, it's kind of hard for you to hear that because you have too many people in the media that want to keep pushing the same narrative of how evil the NFL is. So anyway, 17-game season. I think it's awesome. let's talk about how Deshaun Watson's kind of a scumbag. So as I said last week, I'm very hesitant about making any type of definitive assertions as to what happened in the whole Deshaun Watson incident, or the Deshaun Watson incidents, as they will. However, Sports Illustrated released an article titled "A Massage Therapist on Her Session with Deshaun Watson." Mary, who I don't know if that's her actual name or that's just the name that she's using for the article, but Mary says she was subjected to inappropriate behavior from Watson in 2019 and found out she wasn't the only one. She isn't among the Tony Busby clients filing suit, but she wants her story told. So this article was released on March 29th, which was a few days ago, and she went into some pretty graphic detail as to what happened. And her explanation for why she's now gone public is, quote, "The one thing I keep thinking about is he's about to get traded to another place. What if he goes to Atlanta or California or anywhere else? He would have a whole new community of massage therapists to target," end quote. So in this, like I said, she details an incident that took place when she massaged or had a session with Deshaun Watson. So pretty much the way this works was she has another friend who works with higher profile, whether it's athletes, actors, actresses, star people, celebrities, if you will. And so this was like a third party type thing that set this up. He came in through a back entrance, and she took him in. So this is from the article. I'm going to read this. This is a couple paragraphs long, but I want to read it because you need to hear this account. So, and I quote from the article, "Mary didn't know the client would be Watson until about 15 minutes before the appointment, which she says was routine when she'd receive a referral. The other therapist also relayed that she presented as a standard request from Watson to use a towel for the session rather than sheets. Mary put out a bench-sized towel for maximum coverage. When Mary books clients, she requires them to fill out an intake form, which stipulates that draping will be used during the session so that only the area being worked on will not be covered. The Texas Commission of Licensing and Regulations adopted in February of 2020 a requirement that genitals and all gluteal coverage must be draped during massages. Most licensed therapists already require this in their practice." So obviously this, just pulling out of the article for a second, this was obviously not in place in 2019. It is in place now. And I go back to the article. Quote, "Since Watson's appointment was set up through a third party, Mary's understanding was that the other therapist would handle the paperwork, though she can't say for certain whether Watson received or reviewed those rules. She used the oversized towel to drape him until about 45 minutes into the session when she says he tossed the towel onto the floor saying it was too itchy. Watson was lying face up on the table, naked and totally uncovered, something Mary says has never happened during any of her other massage appointments. I was in shock, Mary said. She proceeded with the massage without the towel, knowing that her payment was coming from another therapist. I trusted the therapist that referred him to me and that nothing weird was going to happen. After 90 minutes, Watson asked to extend the session for another hour. She continued to work only on his quads, inner thighs, and abdomen, the specific areas he requested. Watson developed an erection, she says, and also began clenching and slowly thrusting the air. Mary at first wondered whether his movements were a pain response to her deep tissue work, so she asked whether he was okay. She said he replied that he was fine and stopped thrusting for a short time. Mary learned during her massage training that erections can develop as a relaxation response. She recalls situations in the past when that's happened to clients while they dozed off. They usually become embarrassed when they realize it and start talking about something random to divert their thoughts. If that doesn't work, she'll sometimes switch to a more painful massage technique. But Watson's behavior indicated to her that his intentions were different. She adds, "There was one point that he did tell me that I could move his penis if I needed to, and I just completely ignored him. She took this as a suggestion to touch his exposed penis. Watson stayed on his back for the entire session. While massaging his abdomen, Mary says she noticed different fluids on his stomach. She remembers questioning whether it was pre-ejaculate, telling herself, this can't be what I think it is. In the final 5 to 10 minutes of the session, Mary says Watson began thrusting his pelvis in the air again, this time much faster. At that point, I recognized it for what it was, Mary says. She says she told him he needed to calm down. He stopped. The session ended, and she left the room to let him get dressed. When she returned, he gave her a hug. Because of his request to use a back entrance, she then had to walk him out of the building. Mary says she immediately told the other massage therapist who referred Watson to her everything that happened. She remembers the other therapist telling her that she would talk to Watson. Mary also called a family member directly following the session. Sports Illustrated spoke to this relative who remembers taking Mary's call that afternoon at a stoplight at a specific intersection in Houston. The relative's account of what Mary told her then aligns with Mary's description of the incident now. She also recalls Mary's shock and disbelief that day. End quote. All right, sorry. So that was kind of a long excerpt, but I felt like it is necessary to actually read the whole thing. So again, here's the deal. This is one account. Obviously, it's one person's account. There's two sides to every story. I'm not saying that Watson's guilty here. I'm holding off on doing that, but these allegations are pretty damning at this point. Now we're getting into specifics. Before, it was a he said, she said, she said, she said, she said type of thing where you've had over almost two dozen women coming forward and saying that, look, something's happened. But now you're starting to have people come out of the woodwork who aren't even looking for money and saying, not only did this happen, but I'm going to give you a play-by-play of what took place. And she's even said, I'm not looking for money. I just want an apology. I just want a public apology for treating me the way that he treated me. So when you're looking at, when you take that at face value and you sit back and go, okay, so this woman's not even looking for money. She's just looking for a public apology. She just wants him to come out and say, look, I screwed up and I'm sorry. That makes her much more believable than somebody who's just kind of grifting for a payday, if you will. So again, I'm not saying he did it. I'm not saying he didn't do it, but the dude is coming across as kind of a douchebag and a pretty scummy human being. I don't know if this guy's ever going to play in the NFL again. I'm telling you that right now. It's now looking like criminal charges are going to be coming for him. And if that's the case, I wouldn't be shocked if the NFL suspends him indefinitely. He's definitely going to go on the on the commissioner's exempt list. I think that is going to happen anytime now. And that will still allow him to make his money, but it'll allow the NFL to further into the investigation, and it'll keep Watson off the field until they figure out everything that they need to figure out. So like, as the story continues to unfold, I will continue to talk about it. I'll be as objective about this as I possibly can. Again, I'm not saying he's guilty. I'm not saying he's innocent. More evidence obviously needs to come forward, but this is pretty damning stuff. And we'll see what happens as we keep moving forward here. So I realized that I've never talked about this before, and it's something that has irritated me for years. And I've really noticed it as I've watched a lot of both the men's and women's basketball tournament over the past couple weeks. And that's the fact that players dap up their teammate after missed free throws. It used to be that you would give your teammate a high five or a slap on the ass when they would make the free throw as a, hey, nice shot, man. Way to go. Congrats. Keep it up. That type of thing. Like just keeping the player's energy up. Giving them, you know, a high five after they make it. I mean, it would be no different than somebody hitting a layup, and as they're running back on the court, you slap them on the butt like, hey, nice work type of deal. But over the past, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, and this really started in the NBA, and it's trickled down to college basketball, even to, I'm sure, high school as well, where when a player misses a shot, they're still getting high-fived. Why? Why are you high-fiving somebody after they miss a free throw? That's never made any sense to me. So you're dapping them up after they miss the shot. Like, hey, congratulations. Nice work missing that shot, man. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You'll get it again. How soft is that? And I don't want to hear the argument about, oh, you're just boosting up the morale. You're just giving them a high five and saying, hey, it's okay. We got your back. No, absolutely not. A free throw is the easiest shot in the game to make because it's the only one that's not contested. This is coming from somebody who sucks at basketball. when I played basketball when I was younger, I had two things I could do. I could play defense and I could make my free throws. And that was because that's what my coach had us do. He would have us run suicides until we were about ready to pass out. And then he would make us all go to the free throw line and shoot free throws for like 15, 20 minutes. And his explanation for why we would do that is the whole point in playing aggressive and going for a shot or driving to the basket is obviously you want to make the shot. But if you don't make the shot, you're very likely going to get fouled. And then you need to go to the free throw line and you need to be able to make those two free throws. Otherwise, being aggressive and going to the basket like that and getting fouled was all for naught. You didn't do anything. You didn't gain any points. And also, it's a free shot. It's the whole point, free throw. It's a free shot, and it's just you and the basket. Nobody can prevent you from making the shot except for you, and it comes down to just you and the ball. You and the ball in the basket. So there's no explanation for why your teammates are going to turn around or should turn around and dap you up after you miss the shot. If anything, they should look at you and look at you sideways, but like, really, dude? Really? You're going to miss that? What the hell's wrong with you? Wake up. It's a free shot. I don't give a shit if it's men's or women's. We've really reached to the point in this society where we have to high-five each other when we miss shots. It's one thing to celebrate when you're making shots, but why am I celebrating you if you miss a shot, especially if you missing that free throw costs us the game? I'm not going to be pumped about it. I don't give a shit if you're my teammate or not. I'm out here working my ass off just as hard as you are to win a game. Why am I going to give you kudos because you missed a shot? I felt this way for years, not so much about the, not just the dapping up thing, but the fact that as far as I'm concerned, you should not be able to play specifically professional basketball. College basketball is different. You're getting a scholarship and you're younger. But professional in the NBA, if you shoot sub 80% from the free throw line, you should be cut immediately. I'm sorry, you should be cut immediately. And Shaq's one of the greatest players of all time, but it was obscene that he shot right around 50% for his career at the free throw line. That's inexcusable. You should not be that bad from the free throw line. Again, it's a free shot. Non-contested. It's just you, ball, basket. Shouldn't be a problem. But anyway, I can't stand, it drives me up a wall watching players slap each other on the butt, give them high fives after missing a shot. You don't see that anywhere else. You don't see somebody shoot a three, miss the three, and as they run back to play defense, somebody's running up to them, giving them a high five, being like, oh, it's all good, bro. Don't worry about it. It's okay that you missed that three. That never happens. So why are we doing it for free throws? It's just so soft. It really is. It's just indicative of our culture. It's absolutely pathetic. There's no other word to say it. It's just pathetic. All right, so I'm going to touch on this topic real quick, and then we'll move on to my interview with Austin Space to close out the pod. So Megan Rapinoe went to the White House last week to talk about the pay disparity between men and women, the men's and women's national team. All right, now I'm going to read an excerpt of what she said, and then I'm going to explain to you why what she said is a complete and utter lie. And I know that you're not allowed to say that. That makes me a villain, and oh, she's a hero. She's not a hero because she's not telling you the truth. And I have a problem when the media is distorting what it in parsing between fact and fiction. And they've done everything they can to try and build Megan Rapinoe up as this paragon of virtue, when all it takes is a quick Google search and you realize that pretty much everything Megan Rapinoe is, or Rapinoe, I don't know why the hell I'm calling her Rapinoe, Megan Rapinoe is saying is completely and utterly false. She said, and I quote, "I'm a member of the LGBTQ community with pink hair, and where I come from, I could have only dreamed of standing in the position I am today at the White House. I'm also a professional athlete, and I've helped along with all of my teammates virtually here today, one teammate literally here today, win four World Cup championships and four Olympic gold medals for the United States." That part is factual, okay? So that first sentence is absolutely factual. Here's where the lie starts, and I quote, "Despite those wins, I've been devalued. I've been disrespected and dismissed because I am a woman. I've been told that I don't deserve any more than less because I am a woman. You see, despite the wins, I'm still paid less than the men who do the same job that I do." Okay. So here's the deal. Here's where, this is why I'm saying that she's completely lying. And that's because the reason why there's a pay disparity is because that's what the women collectively bargained. Okay. So in March of 2019, the U.S. women's national team filed a lawsuit against U.S. soccer over alleged gender pay discrimination. In May 2020, a judge dismissed a major part of that lawsuit in which the plaintiffs wanted to restructure their collective bargaining agreement to be like the men's teams. The judge threw out the request, noting that the women's soccer team had rejected such an agreement in earlier negotiations with U.S. soccer. And I'm quoting from the judge here. The WNT was willing to forego higher bonuses for benefits such as greater base compensation and the guarantee of a higher number of contracted players. Accordingly, plaintiffs cannot now retroactively deem their CBA, collective bargaining agreement, worse than the men's national team CBA by reference to what they would have made had they been paid under the men's national team pay-to-play term structure when they themselves rejected such a structure, end quote. So again, this goes back to collective bargaining. Same thing with the NFL players. When the NFL players are now bitching about the 17th game, you collectively bargained that. The women collectively bargained this. This was something that they determined that they wanted, and now they're turning around in the 11th hour and saying, oh no, we want to make more money. Okay, well, you had the option to make more money. You chose, and you actually chose the right course of path. They made the right choice in this sense. They don't bring in as much revenue as the men's team. They don't. They've actually technically lost money in the past. So they made the right move for themselves, financially speaking. They really did. But they're pissed because the men's were making more money. Well, the men pull in more revenue. They just do. So to further detail this, the United States Soccer Federation released a fact sheet explaining that the women's team lost the federation millions of dollars, and yet they still out-earned their male counterparts. The women's team, while claiming an equal treatment, collectively bargained for their pay structure, just like the men's team. The women receive a base salary of $100,000 each year and an additional salary of $67,500 or $72,500 for playing in the National Women's Soccer League. The men's team does not have this agreement, and they only receive bonuses. The women's team also receive bonuses at a higher percentage of what the men's team earns, yet because women's soccer brings in less money, they receive less in bonuses. The women's team also has benefits like a retirement plan and health insurance. The men's team does not receive any of those benefits. So again, for Megan Rapinoe to stand up in front of the country and even the world to say that the women's team is paid in a disparaging way less than the men's team is completely and utterly false. She is lying. And again, you have places like ESPN, MSNBC, CNN that have propped her up as this paragon of virtue of, oh, look at her standing up for women's rights. She's not standing up for anything because she's standing on nothing but a pile of lies. Again, I Googled this. This isn't hard to Google. And if our media was actually interested in fact-checking instead of virtue signaling, they would have called her out by now and said, look, I can appreciate where you're coming from and the fact that you believe that you should be paid more because you guys win at a higher rate than the men's, which is true, they do, but you guys collectively bargained for this. And if we're going to go full scope here, the reason why they collectively bargain the way that they do, and I just talked about this a moment ago when I was reading the excerpt from the U.S. Soccer Federation, the fact of the matter is that they've actually lost the federation millions of dollars because nobody tunes in to watch them play. Not trying to be mean here, but the reason why the men make the money that they make is because they bring in more revenue. It's that simple. They bring in more revenue. More people are interested in watching the men's team than they are the women's team. Now, if you want to have a larger debate about, well, that's unfair, more people should watch the women's team, look at how great they are, I'm sure, absolutely. I don't argue that. I've said the same thing about when it's come to women's college basketball. I've talked about how I enjoy watching women's college basketball in some instances more than the men's, mainly because the team that I root for in UConn is always dominant and always great to watch. So you can make that argument if you want to. But that's a completely separate conversation from the fact that the reason why the pay disparity is the way that the pay disparity is A, because they collective bargained, so they chose this route, by the way. This was something that Megan Rapinoe decided to do. That's number one. And number two, the fact of the matter is they've lost they've lost money for the Federation, and the reason why they're losing money is because nobody is tuning in to watch them or going to their games. That's not the men's national team's fault. That's also not the U.S. Soccer Federation's fault. Nor is it FIFA's fault as a whole, as a world, as a worldwide organization. It's not FIFA's fault that people aren't tuning in to women to watch women's soccer. Look at it this way. Why is it that if we compare it to the NBA and the WNBA, real quick, and then I'm going to move on. The NBA players make more money than the WNBA players. Why is that? Because the NBA makes a buttload more money in revenue than the WNBA. The reason why LeBron James can get paid what LeBron James gets paid is because the NBA brings in so much money. It's a billion-dollar enterprise. The WNBA is not a billion-dollar enterprise. So you can't have Breonna Stewart making $30 million a year, because $30 million is close to what the whole WNBA revenue is in this an entire season. So you can't have players making multi-millions of dollars in the WNBA because there's not that money. There's no money to go around. The owners of the WNBA are not making that kind of money. So you can't justify paying players that amount. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a WNBA. The organization would go broke. And the fact that the media is so freaking disingenuous and they're only interested in the narrative rather than being honest with everybody about revenue, it really is frustrating. Because the fact of the matter is, it breaks it down to this basic philosophy. Money in, money out. You can't take the money out if you don't have the money coming in. It's that simple. This is high school stuff. Hell, this is elementary school stuff. It's not that hard to figure out. It's really not. So again, the fact that Megan Rapinoe is making the statements that she's making, she should be called out for it. She just should. I'm sorry. You know, you can like her and you can like what she stands for and the fact that, you know what, I believe that women should be paid the same as men, and you can go down that rabbit hole if you choose to, and that's fine. I'm not telling you not to be an activist. I'm not telling you not to stand up for women's rights and women being paid the same as men. That's fine. That is a fair argument to make, but you cannot make it when it comes to sports. Sports is the ultimate meritocracy. You make the money that you make because of the eyeballs that are viewing you. The NBA would not make what the NBA is making if people didn't watch the NBA. The NFL sure as hell would not make what NFL players are making if people didn't tune into the NFL. That's just facts. So again, to stand up in front of the country, in front of the world, and say that we're not being treated fairly because we're women, that is not true. It is not factually true. It's disingenuous at best, and it's completely and utterly duplicitous at worst. Now let's talk to Austin Space. All right, everybody. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the podcast my co-host on the Spaceball podcast, brought to you by this network, and that is Austin Space. Austin, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing great. Happy to be back on La Valley Sports Talk. I love being on the show. I mean, the first time I was on the show was that big hour-long interview. Was that it? Remember that?
Yeah. You came home, I think it was for Christmas, I believe.
Yeah.
Something like that. And you, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was back when I was living in the condo, and you came and sat down in the studio and we chatted for like an hour. I just interviewed the hell out of you. I asked you.
Oh, that was so fun. That was
a whole lot of questions.
But always happy to be back on, and happy Spaceball's back. Thanks for having me on, my dude.
Yeah, well, you know, I got to have you on so you can talk about how great the show is going to be.
Well, first of all, couldn't do the show without you. So I remember we talked about this. So it's always fun to sit here and talk baseball with you. It was also fun to come on and cover your show for 1 week. That was fun.
Remember that? You did a great job, man. That was awesome.
That was a lot of fun, but I feel like, you know, I know you give me some credit for the solo thing. That's very hard to do. So I got to give you a lot of credit on that, because I'm a very, especially podcast wise, very conversational show person. So I think the show really works well with our dynamic and us debating at what's going on in baseball all season long. So.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we just recorded the first episode and it came out pretty nice. And by the time this podcast comes out anyway, the first episode will be available. So go download it. And we didn't really argue too much. I mean, you did tell me to push back on you if I felt like I needed to, and I was a little upset about your take on my Yankees. But outside of that, you know, we were pretty.
I thought, not high in them. You know,
we didn't
just not high in them.
I don't
we
really think we
too much later on. I will say that's the thing. We're going to be both wrong. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could definitely be wrong about the National League if since we were both on the same page with the Braves, but
very much so.
Outside of that, I mean, I don't really think we disagree too much. I mean, we do have different, obviously we have different AL pennant winners, but outside of that, we seem to be pretty much on the same page for the most
part. I think so. Yeah.
At least for right now. Anyway, we'll see what happens as the season progresses.
Once this trade deadline hits, I mean, it's going to be big. I was looking into it. We're actually going to have a very enormous class at this trade deadline. You know, you got Trevor Story out there and Lindor. I was looking at Jose Ramirez. I mean, it's going to be nuts. It's going to be nuts. Bunch of pitchers. So it's going to be really interesting and fascinating to see where we are midpoint through the season, what teams do make the move and what teams don't. And there, it's a whole lot of folks to choose from. It wasn't last year where we're sort of like, do we get Robbie Ray? This is like, okay, do we get the big guy? Do we rent the big guy this year? Mm-hmm. There's going to be some big names floating around out there for sure. JD Martinez, another one. So we
didn't really bring it up on the episode, mainly because the Red Sox just didn't come up. So I figured this is a great time to talk to you about your team.
Oh,
you know, okay. Last year was a bit rough.
So, I told you.
yes, you did. So I'm wondering how optimistic are you feeling this year? Are you more or less optimistic than you were last year? Do you like the fact the core is coming back? Does that not make you happy? What's your feelings about the organization overall?
Very complex question. A little loaded there. Core situation just totally reminds me of, what did we do this song and dance for last year? We suspended him for 2 months for what? AJ Hinch is with the Tigers and Core is with the Red Sox. Okay. What did we teach anybody? What was the point? And you know who suffered worse out of this? Carlos Beltran, who never even got a chance to do it. And he wasn't a manager. It's so unfair to him. So we got these other guys because of it. Don't even get me started. It was ridiculous. That was a whole nonsense thing. So everybody could think the Red Sox and Houston and all these other teams had this high moral stand ground when really nobody cares and everybody's cheating. Okay. That's what really happened with that. So, and Alex Cora too, people forget, and I'm hard on him because we could have absolutely lost big time with how he handled game 3 of the World Series against the Dodgers, where he blew it, Evaldi, and said, we're not using you. And then somehow I thought the whole series was over at that point. So we'll see, but I don't know. I don't think it's really going to make much of a difference what Cora does. You know, the real reason the Red Sox won was because JD Martinez was there to finally replace David Ortiz. That's why they won that year, not Alex Cora. As far as this though, the lineup goes, I'm a lot more optimistic than I was last year. Alex Verdugo is a nice little player, isn't he?
Like, yeah, he's good.
He's a solid little player. He's going to hit he's like right-handed Benintendi, but better, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, that's actually a really fair comparison.
Yeah. And we look at, it looks like the Red Sox are really going to build their team, and as they should, around Xander Bogaerts and Rafael Devers. Rafael Devers is a solid player and going to be good. It looks like, and the other thing that's going to be interesting to watch is we have Eduardo Rodriguez coming back. They signed Garrett Richards, who isn't that bad. And I don't think Chris Sale comes back this year, or if he does, it's going to be way later on. But if he does, I mean, they're not that bad of a team. They're really not that bad as they're going to be last year. I have him finishing third. I have him finishing over Toronto because I think nobody's going to pay attention to them, and I think they're going to be okay. And Tampa's not as good as it was last year. So I think the AL East is going to be more even and more tight than it was last year. So the Red Sox, I'm not going to say whatever, but the Red Sox have a possibility. They have a path to make the playoffs. That's possible. I don't think they will, but they could.
How do you feel about Jarren Duran?
Who is this?
So I was reading when I was reading up on your Red Sox this year, there is on MLB.com, they're talking about how they had a bold prediction about Jarren Duran and how he would take over center field and lead off by June.
Let's see here. I don't know so much about this guy.
Okay.
Let's take a look at him.
All right. So he was the number 4 prospect.
Okay.
And so their write-up here is that Almost unfathomably, the thrilling and homegrown outfield trio of Andrew Benintendi, Jackie Bradley Jr., and Mookie Betts that helped the Red Sox win a World Series title in 2018 is entirely gone. Though the Sox have one solid everyday piece in Alex Verdugo, their other two outfielders are more like platoon pieces.
Franchy Cordero and all that. Yeah.
Yep.
And Hunter Renfro. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're saying this could pave the way for the club's number four prospect, Duran, to make his entry into Major League Baseball fairly early in the season. Duran has speed to burn and energizing power and projects as a leadoff hitter.
Well, I mean, the path is there. So why not? That's probably part of why they got rid of Benintendi, you know, because they don't really need him. Martinez will also play probably a little bit in right field if somebody needs like a half day off or something as a DH. But I don't know. It's one of those things. It's really hard. I'm not the best at like determining prospects or anything like that, to be frank.
I was just wondering.
But I will agree the opportunity is there. If you're good enough to play, you'll be there. There's really no roadblock for him. So
we'll
see how he does. And
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish.
Oh, that was it. I was going to say, we'll see how he does. Yeah.
Were you happy with or were you bummed that they didn't re-sign Benintendi, or are you just kind of like, whatever?
Benintendi has been like on the downslope, man. And, again, I was one of those people that wasn't, all upset when Mookie Betts left because I knew it was inevitable. I think I would probably be more hesitant and weird if they got rid of like Devers or Bogarts. I think that's who you need to build this team around. Bogarts gets better and better every year, so much as does Devers. And those are the guys that you want to bring around. And if those guys can be curated and become these superstars, which they kind of growing into it, like Devers can hit, man, that guy can hit. All right. And Bogarts runs a solid infield and bats like 280. That's great. That's great for a shortstop. I'll take it. Those are the guys I want to build the team around. I don't see JD Martinez coming back. I don't see, I mean, this starting rotation, like Chris Sale's done. I'm of the mind Chris Sale's done and all this other stuff. So I think the only pieces I care about are those two, you know, because that's going to attract talent that you can homegrown. You already signed Bogarts. See if you can get Devers in there and then build from there. That's kind of what I'm seeing, because you're not committed to anything. And now, like, the only one we're committed to is like, what, Sale? We're just throwing money away now. That's about it. I'll take that.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you got anything else? Anything else that you want to talk about?
Nothing really.
No, because you answered all my questions about the Red Sox. So now, you know, I'm just, do you have anything you want to plug? I mean, that's really why I like to have you come on too.
Sure.
Do you want to talk about anything that you're working on, or is everything still hush hush in like a vault somewhere and you can't talk about it?
It's been a minute, man. I mean, you all know I do the Pointless 64 podcast outside of the Sidelight Network because I don't want the man strangleholding my podcast here.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, Richard's tough like that. He's a real pain in the ass.
But no, I mean, I season 3 is out. We did Generation 1 Pokemon. We if you're a baseball fan, the first one you were on, we did MLB mascots, and that was that was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun doing that. In between that, we did Christmas songs. So we took
that one was fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a really competitive one. I have some in the works. It's just tough getting people in and figuring out the right people that I have to connect with to get this song and dance together. So I'm quasi working on season 4, but and I have the ideas for 4 and 5, but they're not there yet. But they'll come. I love doing the show and would love to have you back at some point whenever we get to a point there. But for those who don't know, it's basically like March Madness, but we do topics usually of pop culture of some sort. And I do it in a very mathematical way, you know, much like your hotness there, except way more mathematical.
Madness, bracket of hotness. Thank you for plugging that. So 2 follow-ups. One, sure. It's more of like just a statement I wanted to say. So as somebody who really knows nothing about Pokemon, and I knew literally nothing, very, very basic. I had a Game Boy game of it, but that was because everybody had a Game Boy game of it. I played it for like 5 minutes and went, this is stupid. I don't enjoy this whatsoever. I'm going back to Donkey Kong.
You still bought gold though. You bought the sequel.
I didn't buy anything. I got those as gifts because I told Santa that that's what I wanted. And
you just to fit in or whatever.
Yeah, just to fit in. I wanted to be cool like everybody else. But anyway, enough about me. You guys, what makes your show so good is that as somebody who knows nothing about Pokemon, I'm listening in and I'm actually riveted because you bring on such great panelists that are so knowledgeable about the subject matter that they make people like me who don't know what the hell they're talking about actually intrigued in the topic. And I think that that's a testament to the show. And that's why, you know, if for those of you who haven't listened to it, go back, listen to season one, listen to season two, and listen to season three. Because even if you're not interested in baseball mascots, you will be, because we make it fun, light, and stupid. But season
and also
two,
informative, like, you, like,
yeah,
all the research we all had to do to bring into that thing.
Oh, absolutely. Or, yeah. But season two, though, and this is my favorite season, nothing against, you sure, know, Pokemon sure, or the mascots, but the people that you brought on, your panelists that you brought on, were incredible. They were talented. They were, both of them were in the music industry, mm-hmm, in some way, shape, or form. And it was the amount of knowledge. Now, somebody who I played very little piano when I was younger, so I know very basic musical kind of crap. The amount of insight that I was gaining about just music and the way people are creating the composition of the music and things of that nature, it was just unbelievable. And it was also very competitive too. Like that was, it was cutthroat, which was, it was awesome.
Crazy. It was crazy. Anybody could have won that one actually at one point. And then, you know, like things love, you know how things go in brackets. Like you and I are out of it right now. Like who do you have right now for March Madness?
I have Gonzaga, but I'm
okay,
still.
Okay, me too. Okay, so we're not out of it, but
we're not out of it, but we're out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No. You and I have similar brackets in that usually. But I will say this, like speaking of season two, like, yeah, I mean, that's part of it is where it depends on the season, but usually I sort of serve as like the everyman. I've realized I'm sort of like the vessel for the audience, depending on the topic of some sort, because I'm the one doing it, especially that season. I don't know enough about, like, I know Pokemon. I mean, I know baseball mascots as much as anybody who would know baseball, but I very have little knowledge on the music industry like these two. So I think that's what adds to the fun is that I come in and I always research my show, but these people are so naturally talented. They devoted their lives to the hobby that we're talking about, which is incredible. And then what they do, you know, all of my guests come in with this expertise and then they can learn. So that's one of the things I like about doing the show is that I'm learning stuff as I'm doing it amongst my research, because I have these panelists taking it just as seriously and probably even more seriously than I am. Like in season two, for particular, learning about the history of We Three Kings was just something I never really thought going into the season we'd ever have. I really appreciate that, because it is really a show for everybody. If you just, even if it's not the topic that you are whatever in, you might just learn something about it just listening. I know you didn't participate in this one, but you're having an interest just learning about what anime reference Blastoise was in and what, you know, like just silly things like that are brought up. And it's just a lot of fun for people to participate in a variety of ways, whether actively or just enjoying the competition, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and again, I think that's the brilliance of the concept of this show, though, yeah, is that you don't have to really know the subject matter.
Yeah, the barrier of entry is just start with the first episode of the season. That's all you got to do.
Exactly. And just sit back and enjoy. So the other follow-up I had for you, and maybe you don't know this yet, and if you don't, that's fine. Okay. Do you have a possible date for season four, or is that still kind of just really in the works here?
Okay. I got to make my reaches out, but ideally, I'll say this ideally, so you'll get the scoop of this. Ideally, I want it in June.
Okay.
Ideally. Cool. That's a far away, but I'm really planning something here.
Okay.
Season five, and I'll even throw this, ideally I want that in October. Those are the two ones. So then you can sit there, you can figure out what we're going to do. But that's my plan. That's my plan.
Hopefully. All right, you heard it here first. You know,
sometimes these things don't work out.
That's all right. That's all right. I was just wondering. I mean, because before you were kind of banging these out every you had what, like a mm-hmm. month in between. So I was just, you know, I know that you have a little bit more of a lag between three and four. And I was just, as somebody who enjoys listening to your stuff, I was just wondering, you know, when I'm going to get some more of that content. That's all.
I know. I wanted to get the first four out, but I ended up getting three out. So I really wanted to crank those out as quickly as possible. And then especially between season two and three, I needed to get something in. And that was, I mean, we pushed that. That was the absolute limit. We went a week into the new year on that one. season three is where I want it, but now it's at a point where I can really, okay, people are gaining interest. New people come in for the topics, and it's now I'm talking the business side of it, but it's like, it's really just, it's a lot of behind the setting up and the organizing, the talent coordination of it is probably the hardest part of the show. In addition, and I'm also talking about mathematically going, okay, how am I going to organize these Pokemon? You know, like it's weird, you know, or okay, this doesn't qualify because of this Christmas song release. So it's very weird task I've put myself through, but I like it. I like statistically putting stuff together. That's the baseball mind of me there. So,
well, I mean, in all the hard work and dedication put into it comes out in the show.
Thank you. Well, yeah. I hope we can have you back again on another sports one, whenever the tides turn in that direction. We'll bring you back for one of them.
I came out in season one and I dominated, and that I don't ever need to come back as far as I'm concerned.
Dominated.
I'm 1-0. People don't need to know the particulars. The point is I'm 1-0. It's all that matters.
Oh, well, it's a better record than me. but yeah, man, no, I really appreciate the plugs for that. And I really appreciate you coming here to co-host. And I know we talk about how Spaceball is my show, but it's just as much as your show too. I think we work well together on that. And I'm just really looking forward to a full baseball season, working on this, talking baseball. If you want to sit here and hear some raw opinions that maybe are less than popular, but I'll give you the raw truth. You can hear it from me, and maybe even some debates from LaValle if he thinks I'm going too hard on somebody or something. So
mostly just my Yankees, but yeah, outside of that. Yeah. All right, man. Well, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on. I appreciate it. And
thank you, guys.
Be sure to check out season 2, episode 1 of Spaceball, which is currently available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, Austin. I really appreciate it. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the LaValle Sports Talk Podcast, brought to you by the Soundline Network. As always, thank you so much for tuning and listening. I greatly appreciate it. Please be sure to check me out on iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review. And while you're there, we got plenty of other podcasts for you, including Spaceball, which is back, Drinks with Dan, Richo's Rant, and of course, Richo and Lala. Speaking of Richo and Lala, we have finally reached the finale of our March Madness bracket of hotness, where we have Jana Kramer facing off against Skylar Diggins. Be sure to place your votes. We will, of course, release who won our second annual bracket on Monday. So be sure to check that out. And that's it. That's all I have for you this week. Hope you all be well and stay safe. Talk to y'all again soon.